Hi, everybody. This is Armand Demel.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
With you here on the Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM, brought to you by the good graces of Pacifica Radio and T-Dub, our engineer today, doing a stellar job. So we've been talking to you this week about impulses. Well, I started talking yesterday about impulses, and Roberta and I did a little further checking into this to teach you about impulse control. It just gets more and more interesting, huh, Roberta?
Sure does, Armand. Yes, every step of the way.
Every step of the way. Talk about that planet.
The planet, yes. Oh, this is fascinating.
Go ahead, jump to it. We're going to get there. First of all, this has to do with alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about drinking, we have a question which we'll address later, which is not why does people become alcoholic, but why doesn't everybody become alcoholic? Because it seems that there's some good basis for it. And in fact, radio astronomers, what did they do?
They found that there is a planet in a distant constellation that has an atmosphere comprised of billions of liters of pure alcohol.
Pure alcohol.
Believe it or not, that is the truth. So if you live there, I wonder.
You live in an alcohol atmosphere. Right?
Right, yes.
Just surrounded by ethanol?
But see, I thought that
it's
ethanol, and which is alcohol in simple English. I thought that alcohol only existed on Earth because it comes from sugar. So I had the, misconceived idea that it only existed here. But of course it makes sense. Why not? After all, the chemicals that the Earth is made up of are the chemicals that you find everywhere else in the universe.
Where do you think the Martian martini came from?
Oh, is that
the word martini comes from Mars?
Right, of course.
I'm making that up.
Mm.
Listen, friends, we're going to lay a groundwork here, and this is a very important groundwork. I realize that all of my colleagues are reluctant to make the following statement. Here's the way it goes. Rough childhoods must, not could, but must lead to a pathological adaptation. Get that phrase. Rough childhood must lead to pathological adaptation. Here's the way it is, plain and simple. If you had a rough childhood, you're going to grow up funny. And funny means you're not going to be grow up ordinary. You're not going to be like everybody else. It's very simple. A rough childhood, and we're going to describe rough childhoods as being stress-related, fear-related, hyper-arousal, disrupted attachment, and we're going to go into a definition of it. But what we're saying is you got to be just a little bit wacky, and wacky means not ordinary if you had a rough childhood.
Well, and that is because nature is such that if you are challenged with a difficult environment, either you figure out a way to adapt to it by being abnormal, or you perish. So being abnormal in an abnormal environment allows a person to survive through the challenges. It's that simple. And being abnormal may be the only way to survive.
Well, it seems to be the only way to survive. See, the thing that our colleagues are afraid to say, and I say colleagues meaning social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists, mental health practitioners, as well as physicians, they all say, well, so you had it rough, you're okay. But you see, here's the truth. The truth of it is, if you had it rough, friend, you're not okay. You're not like everybody else. And we're going to go along with this. We're going to talk about the adaptation. So just as much as everybody would like to sit around and say, oh, my parents, they did their best. Well, maybe they did their best. But if you are lacking in some of the vital areas which we're going to talk about, you're screwed up.
Yes. The parents, the what what the parents did or did not do or a judgment on the parents is a different issue. It's not what we're talking about.
It's irrelevant.
It is irrelevant because it may have been their very best, but what it did to us remains, and that's what we're talking about. And I think, Armand, it would be a good idea to start by describing how the brain develops.
How the brain develops. And by the way, we're talking as two kids with rough childhoods.
Yes, we are.
Both Roberta and I. We're not sitting here saying, oh, you poor kids. In fact, the positive mind
we're
is...
We're sitting here saying, us poor kids.
We poor kids.
We poor kids, right.
And we're sitting and we're saying to you, you know, the positive mind, this radio program is all about this. It's all about rough childhoods.
Mm-hmm.
In one form or another. Now, maybe you're one of those that didn't have a rough childhood. Well, then you're going to be related to loving, dealing with, and in business with people who did have rough childhoods. You're going
right.
to get in that taxi cab, and there's going to be somebody there who did have that, and you're going to be having an interaction with the person.
Yeah.
Just as you're going to do it in the schools, you're going to have it everywhere you go. So understanding this is essential. And in fact, the Positive Mind radio program is about getting you to understand the adaptions. The pathological adaptions, the things that people did to get by.
It's about being here to tell the story.
Yeah.
And being here to share the story because the logic conclusion, the logic result of a childhood that was that difficult should have been death. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be destructive or pessimistic, but the brain is not designed, the human nervous system is not designed to cope, to grow normally with abuse, neglect, misunderstanding, and I'm not saying isolated incidents of abuse and neglect. I'm saying continuous abuse and neglect.
In nature, it's the one that doesn't develop. It's the weaker one that becomes food for the others.
Right.
So you know, and when Roberta says you were meant to die.
Mm-hmm.
You were meant, I mean, if you had followed your program, if you were neglected, ignored, beaten,
right.
scared, you know, you were meant to just die, go away, and then maybe somebody else would come along.
And be food for someone else who may have been a little bit more impulsive than you, a little bit more aggressive than you, a little bit more ruthless. And that one may still be around to tell the story. So nice people, unfortunately, don't have an evolutionary advantage in a difficult environment.
So let's talk about how the brain develops. I'm going to give you the choo-choo theory.
The choo-choo theory, yes.
The one
oh,
we developed
I like that
today.
One.
This is it.
Armand is so skilled at developing visuals, so I leave that up to him because I have all of this abstract notion in my head, but Armand is excellent at creating an image out of that. So what I did say was, Armand, let's describe how the brain develops, and it does develop like a bridge, I said, meaning that we have a mass of unformed neuronal substance, neurons. These are the cells that the brain is made of, and they're just sitting there waiting to grow, like a sprout that is just coming out of the earth, and it's waiting to grow, and you don't know which way it's going to grow.
Get this image down. You got to imagine you're a baby, and you got these kind of floppy sprouts around in your head, and they're sitting there, and they don't know what they're going to become. Now, what we want them to become is a railroad track. We want them to have direction. We want to feed your nerve cells so that your cells will aim out and have purpose.
Right. And for that, you need, at least on two levels, nurturance. And that is on the physical level, you need the right food. And on the emotional level, you need the right stimulus. The right food includes protein and fats and carbohydrates and all of these nutrients that are essential for the physical development of neurons. And then you have stimuli, which can be language stimuli. And in a baby, what's the language that you use? It's baby talk. A baby needs to be spoken to in such a way that the baby can understand language, the baby talk.
The idea
Goo-goo-gaga.
Here,
Goo Gaga?
Goo Goo Gaga.
Something like that.
Well, then what does it mean when you talk to your cats that way? You're developing your cat's thinking?
Oopie,
you got Paula here, and we got...
May do something for your own...
Neuronal,
yes.
All right, so what we're saying is you've got a brain, and your brain is kind of like this floppy spaghetti, right? It's sitting there, and it's looking...
That's exactly what it looks like.
It's floppy spaghetti.
Yep.
And it's an interesting thing. When we see people who are properly developed, their brains, their nerve cells, they become like tracks. They aim in a certain direction,
mm-hmm.
and they become somewhat hardened. Now you're getting the little al dente in here, mm-hmm. and you're going to be able to travel along these tracks to where you want to go. So if you have, for example... If you want to be able to remember, learn a new language, you grow these spaghetti strands and you get them out there, and now they're reaching other spaghetti strands and they're having associations and visuals.
But see, but you need to have the goo goo gaga, meaning that you can't go to fluent language skills unless you first have a mother or a caregiver who speaks to you in baby language, which is goo goo gaga, which is you start building these memory bits, the tracks, bit by bit, one after the other, and they grow exactly like a branch, exactly like a track, bit by bit, one after the other. You put them down, and they need reinforcement, meaning that once is not enough. It has to be hundreds of times before that bit gets committed to that memory track, and then it stays there. And then you have it, and it becomes automatic.
And then you grow on that one.
And then you start with just a couple of words, and then you build on those words, and then you get into a full-blown language skill.
We have a photograph here of a brain that's been neglected, that has not had that development, and a brain that did have that development at the same age, at the age of 3 months.
Mm-hmm. 3 years.
3 years. Yes. One brain is half the size.
Yes, it's half the size.
Half the size. Now, how does it happen? What happens is, through neglect, the spaghetti shrivels up.
It doesn't grow.
It doesn't become a track.
Right.
Now, if the spaghetti shrivels up and doesn't grow, then you don't have the intelligence, the language, the ability to reach out there. You don't have the way of getting out in the world, you don't have adaptations.
Well, it's exactly as if you were on this side of a cliff, and you looked at the other side, and you saw that the other side, there's a lot there that you would like to go to. You would like to go to the other side, but you don't have a bridge. So you're looking and you're saying, gee, that's really nice, but I don't know how to get there. If a child has not been treated with attention, for instance, the child is not going to be able to pay attention.
We're going to give you a number of these we're going to run down. Right now, what we're saying to you is the structure of the brain and how you build the brain. If the brain is built, the child has the capacity. If the brain is neglected, and we're going to go on to a number of different neglects and their consequences, the child cannot develop. And this is when you run into people who have stunted affect, stunted growth, stunted intelligence. It's all because the nervous system didn't work, and in fact, it atrophies. The end of the nerves, when they're not used or they're used improperly, they burn up, they sizzle.
Well, and there are three stages, actually, of development. It starts from the brainstem and the midbrain, and that's where your motor skills develop. And that's the more automatic function. Then you have the cognitive section, which is where you learn to think. And then you have the emotional section, and that's where you learn to feel. So in that order, a baby needs to learn first to move his or her muscles, skeleton, tendons, ligaments. Then the child needs to think. And then the child needs to feel, in that order. If any of these stages are neglected on the part of the caregivers, that child will not be able to develop the sequence that's necessary to build an effective nervous system.
This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. Let us talk about some of the different forms of neglect that lead to what we're going to get to today is impulse. We're going to get to an explanation of impulse that we have been talking about and why people are impulse-ridden and why some are not. Now, keep in mind, the desire, an impulse is an adaptation. To have a lack of impulse control means that you have adapted to not have the thing that tells you hold back here and let go there.
But let's say, Armand, that under normal developmental circumstances, a child develops the capacity to hold back impulse and to think before he or she acts.
Because all three levels, the body level,
right,
the mind level, and the emotional level, right, are all working properly.
Mm-hmm. So the child learns to withhold the impulse that says, take that piece of cheese, you know, in the supermarket. A person could be walking down the aisle and sees something that attracts them, and they want to take it. But there's something that says, no, you can't. You're not going to steal anything. Come on. And so they don't. But someone who does not have that mechanism well developed could very well be unable to stop themselves from reaching out, getting that piece of cheese, hiding it in their pockets, and walking out of the supermarket feeling empowered by that act of theft.
Roberta Mariotti talking about impulse control. We're talking about the development of impulse control. We're going to make a bridge in here for you, but we want you to get this idea. It is a mind that is damaged by neglect in some way, that will lead to a problem in impulse control. So if you see somebody who's got a difficulty with impulse control, you could say to yourself, neglected childhood. You could say it. It's real clear. You could tell them and they'll say, oh, no, my mother was a saint. But you have to be able to see it. And if you see it, let's look at some of the
areas.
And
their mother could very well have been a saint. But, I mean, saints are known to neglect humans around them.
You're going to get the church angry.
Okay.
hang in here a minute.
Well, I mean,
saints are saints.
Saints are saints, but not because a person who is a saint is not necessarily someone who is effective at human interactions. They may be effective with divinity, but not necessarily with humans. I shouldn't have said that.
Let's stay off religion for a little bit, Roberta. You know, I understand.
Okay, let's stay off religion, but you brought it up.
I did. Okay, let's talk about impulse control.
Yes.
What are the forms of impulse control that people have? Here are the six forms of impulse control. Now, get this. You, probably being one of our brother or sisters, who have had an equally difficult form of neglect in your early childhood, which may have been minor, but you did have an adaptation, if you're like any of us, unless you are a saint.
Armand.
Just playing with you. Okay, but if you had an adaptation you had to make, here's a way that your impulse controls will come out, okay, or the lack of them. It could be stealing. These are the common forms. It could be anger. It could be violence. It could easily be drug abuse. It could be self-mutilation. And we're going to talk about each one of these. And then we're going to talk about eating. The most common, or one of the most common forms of lack of control of impulses is around eating, and particularly around anorexia.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Binge eating. All of this we're going to cover today.
And spending, too, Armand.
Oh, and I forgot. And spending. Shopping.
Mm-hmm. Shopping, right.
If you've ever had a problem with shopping, spending, if you're extended on your credit cards, right, if you pay interest on your credit cards, you have an impulse control problem. Because that's the idea, as we said yesterday, credit cards say, let's go after those puppies who were damaged in childhood, who don't know how to spend within their range. And we're going to get those damaged ones, and we're going to charge them 20% interest.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're going to be willing to pay it because they don't have the impulse control that stops them from using the credit cards. And so they live off the vultures of the credit card companies, live off the carrion of the damaged children who can't help but shop.
Yes, I do believe, Armand,
live
that
off the carrion of the damaged children. Wow.
Let's write that down. Yes.
Write that down.
The current modern lifestyle is such that you can see how many people have difficulties with impulse control one way or another. And that, to me, says we're all survivors of some form of childhood suffering, that we have been able to survive precisely because we have adjusted in that way. And the brain of a child is already there, but as we grow, it gets denser. It grows a little bit in size, it expands, but most of all, it grows in density. The neurons kind of grow in length, and they curl up and form bridges within one another. If, as we grow, we lack what we need emotionally or nutritionally, and we don't have the necessary safety, comfort, nurturance, nutrients, then impulse control makes a lot of impulsivity makes a lot of sense. It
compensates. We've got two ways to go, Roberta. We could either talk about the different kinds of stress and neglect, which I think we should do.
Yes.
That leads to it. And then we'll talk about how every one of the lack of impulse control is a form of adaptation, and we'll prove the adaptation.
It's kind of
fascinating.
I'll
okay.
follow.
Let's talk about what it's like to be a child and what are the different forms of things that could happen to a child. Ongoing stress. Many children, and it doesn't have to be just bad parents, but you could be living in a society where everything is stress. You could be impoverished. You could be in a country where there is no food. You could be starved half the time.
And, it could even be that your parents love you so much, but they don't have the money for both of them to stay home, so your mom has to bring you to a childcare center, and there you are. Even though she loves you, she can't stay home with you.
Well, that's a different one. That's disrupted attachment.
But it could lead to stress.
Right, but let's just go down the list.
I thought you were talking about stress. Stressful could be being in childcare of someone who you don't know.
So one form is stress. Another form of child stressor that leads to a lack of impulse control is persistent fear. If a child is constantly frightened, and many of you you live to the day, you sixes in the Enneagram, where fear is your baseline, and you live in fear all the time. You're afraid all the time.
And that could be fear because of violence in the home, or fear because you grew up in a neighborhood where there's violence, or fear because you see violence on television, or because you live in a war zone.
Or fear because you are malnourished.
Or fear because you're malnourished.
And your body says you're in danger.
Sure.
And so you go around trembling all the time.
Or fear
it could
because
be neurological disorder.
You're small, and the moment you leave your home, other kids beat you up?
Well, I'm distinguishing two kinds of fear. One is an intrinsic fear. One is a physiologically based fear. That could be just the brain sending a signal to you, you better watch out. And the other is that there is actual danger. Whether there's actual danger or not, you could live in persistent fear. Another condition that leads to a lack of impulse control is hyperarousal,
which is a condition that ensues when there is too much emotional stimulus in your environment, meaning that your nervous system is always turned on, that it never becomes, the parasympathetic never becomes activated. It's always in a sympathetic mode, and that can happen from abuse, from being abused, from being verbally abused, if not physically abused.
It could be noisy. It could be television on all the time.
Even from secondhand smoke, Armand, because a child who inhales the smoke of a parent, his or her system needs to deal with the toxins in the smoke. That could be. But a hyper-aroused child is a child who is unable to rest enough to give his system a chance to recover and repair itself.
And you will
so
see
it's a child
very
who's
often,
depleted.
Very often you'll see somebody who's got a hyper-arousal will be the person who watches TV all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They are addicted to arousal.
Yes.
They stay aroused. They can't sleep without it.
Right.
You know, I mean, it becomes, okay, so hyperarousal, we have persistent fear. Then we have disrupted attachment, and that's what Roberta started talking about before. You're connected, but you're not connected. Your mother says you got to go live with your grandmother for a while I go out shopping. Any number of disrupted attachment, including a mother who doesn't love her child, who doesn't even want to have a child, who leaves the child with people. You pick her up, you touch her, you know, and doesn't want to be with you.
So the child there, let's look at the nervous system of the baby for a moment. The nervous system naturally would tend to grow normally by attaching to the caregiver, and those neurons would develop in a certain way naturally if reinforced by the behavior of the caregiver. But if that's missing, then the child needs to disattach, and therefore the energy that should be invested in that development, which is normal, now has to be invested in development, in disrupting the normal development, because that's not possible. So you have a disinvestment in the natural development and an investment in an abnormal development. A child like that could be a child who displays a lack of interest in the adults around him or her.
Sure. And they have exactly that, disrupted attachment.
Right.
The fives in the Enneagram.
Yeah, they cannot attach to anyone because the time when they tried to attach, that attachment did not work. So they had to withdraw that energy that was being invested there and invest it in the opposite behavior, which is to detach.
But we'll often get attached, a person with this will often get attached to a machine, a video game. They'll get attached to not people because it is the people that could create the biggest damage.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then there's neglect. There's a lack of stimulation is a form of neglect.
Well, neglect, it's obvious why it causes problems. Neglect, the touching. Touching stimulates the skin. All the nervous system is stimulating in a child when the child is held and kissed and touched and carried around and embraced physically by the family. When that does not happen, the nervous system cannot invest in developing a nervous system that is able to tolerate the touch. So now you have a person who doesn't want to be touched, who cannot stand it, actually, to be touched.
And that's one form of neglect.
That's
and
there, one form.
There's another thing called global neglect, which is when you're deprived in more than one area. Language, nobody will talk to you. Social, they give you nobody else, just yourself. You're the only child and there's nobody around. Touch, like Roberta said. So a number of areas like that are the form of... And this is when Roberta was talking about baby talk. Face-to-face baby talk is essential for a child's neuronal development. And if they don't have it, you know, it's very likely they're going to be deprived and they're going to wind up with a life of impulse. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. We're going to talk about impulses. Remember, an impulse is an attempt to rebalance a sensed imbalance. It's when you think there's an imbalance and your body says, I need something and it can't find it. The impulse is meant to feed that to you. When we come back, we're going to go much further into it, and then we're going to talk about some of the food disorders. It's amazing. Amazing what we found. WBAI, 99.5 FM in New York, just about 1:30 here. Music for you, my friends. Music, something brand new. Something brand new. How about, not new, but something you've never heard. Steve Turre, T-U-R-R-E, a well-known trombonist, plays conch shell. Yep, he's one of the best conch shell players you ever heard in your life. You think that could be interesting? Well, listen up here. Here's something that's fascinating. We'll be right back with you. Thank you. maybe a little more of that for you a little later. We are listening. That was Steve Turre, T-U-R-R-E, his song Morning, where he plays a conch shell, and he plays trombone a little later. It's on an album called Hot Java Jazz. Hot Java Jazz. In fact, I think this one is sold by Starbucks. Hot Java Jazz makes sense that it would be. It's on Verve. Armand DeMille here with Roberta Mariotti. If you just tuned in, attracted to the conch, we are here talking about one of those beautiful conches in life, the Fibonacci, you know? Fibonacci?
Fibonacci, yes, I am familiar with that.
Fibonacci, conch. Conch is a Fibonacci, right?
It's structured according to Mr. Fibonacci.
Yeah, what did Mr. Fibonacci teach us?
He figured out that there is a mathematical balance to everything in nature, and that if you look at the way things are built naturally, like the way that the branches grow spiraling around the trunk of the tree, or the way a shell is formed, or the way that the planets move, and the way that things build themselves from the center out, follows a mathematical sequence that goes like this: 1 plus 1 is 2, and then 2 plus 1 is 3, and then 3 plus 2 is 5, and then, so in other words, you add the subsequent, each subsequent number the one before.
So that's it. So the 1 plus 2 equals 3.
And then the 3 plus 2.
You add the number from the number before. And this results in a spiral shape, a form.
Right.
That's the basis of half of nature.
No, all of nature.
No, some people say half. Half the plants. They say half the other plants. The other half of plants don't follow the Fibonacci rule.
I disagree.
I know. Well, Patricia Miranda doesn't disagree, because she's the artist who did the painting we have on display here. Three paintings by Patricia Miranda. She should be able to see on the website. And this is this whole idea about the essence of being, you know? And if only we can understand ourselves.
Actually, I believe the brain develops that way.
Well, that's what I was just thinking. I was sure there's a Fibonacci of the brain.
Oh, there is. In the neurons, the way that we were explaining before, the way they develop, I am certain I have read somewhere that they develop according to that sequence.
According to the same sequence.
Yes, to the Fibonacci sequence.
As opposed to just splitting all the time.
Right.
Well, you know, we're talking about some of the different forms, some of the different forms of neglect that result in people having troubles with impulse control. And in case you're with us and you just tuned in, this is Armand DeMille and Roberta Mariotti. We're here with The Positive Mind.
And we're talking about impulsivity, which is a sister with compulsivity, because nowadays you could hear almost everyone, at least I do, complain about some form of compulsion or other, some form of difficulty with some kind of impulse or other, whether it is shopping or sexual or food or with something.
Well, the difference between a compulsion and an impulse is a compulsion has a structure to it, Roberta. An impulse has no time lapse. You see, in a compulsion, like compulsive hand washing, you do it over and over and over again. But an impulse is a felt sense followed by an immediate behavior, like impulsive buying.
I did say sister.
Yeah, right.
In the sense that they're similar but not the same.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry, yes. Okay, so let's talk about the different impulses, and the different impulses we mentioned before, which are all adaptations, and we're going to explain why these are adaptations. It's fascinating. Stealing. Petty theft, stealing, taking something that doesn't belong to you, stealing a cookie, stealing a bar of soap, taking something off a shelf, taking something from somebody's medicine cabinet. Stealing. People who have low impulse control should not be allowed in your bathroom.
Unless you have
drugs in your medicine cabinet.
But Armand, you know what? I think you're talking about impulsivity in a pathological sense, but we should say that impulsivity really is a normal reaction of the nervous system in a situation where thinking would be detrimental to survival. Let's say that a hungry wolf walks through your door. Well, you better have some impulses there, because if you don't, you may get eaten. So an impulse is not necessarily a bad thing. It's a normal thing. It's a kind of reaction that doesn't involve thought. What we're talking about is when people are not able to control impulse that lead to destructive or antisocial behaviors.
But you know, Roberta, yes, I agree with you. There is some impulse that's automatic, which is instinctive, and I'm not sure that that means the same thing. But when I'm talking about impulsive stuff, and I'm talking about this category specifically, which are all pathological.
Yes.
Which is impulsive stealing, self-mutilation. Now, within a few minutes, you'll be able to understand why people burn themselves with cigarettes, cut their arms with razor blades. You've heard about it, self-mutilation. Well related to anorexia, which we're going to also talk about.
And well related to also suicide attempts.
And suicide attempts. Anger, violence, these are all impulse
aggression.
Controls. Drug abuse is probably the most common form of it. Eating disorders and shopping and spending, okay? And these are all equal in nature because they're all adaptations. How is stealing an adaptation to a deprived childhood? Okay,
oh,
this is the first question.
Sense.
Here's our first question. It makes, under what conditions does the mind say, I better take whatever is there?
Well, of course, if you grew up in an environment that was defined by scarcity of resources, that means that you grow up with the feeling that you have to compete for everything you get your hands on, from food to soap to whatever, shoes, towels, books, whatever you may think you need. So stealing, even though you realize it's antisocial and you may have a conscience that says, you know, you shouldn't do that, but it actually can make a person feel really good when a person comes from that scarcity, because it means you've won against your competitors. If you can steal, you can survive. If you're not able to steal, you may perish in an environment that is scarce.
The way the mind interprets it, you're weakened. Now, we have to ask about Winona Ryder and people
sure.
like that who grew up with silver spoons in their mouth, why they're stealing, because we're not just talking about deprivation of resources, mean physical resources. If you are deprived of emotional resources, it is highly likely that you will turn out being a kleptomaniac.
Right.
Okay, and that means you can't control yourself. Now, here's the thing about stealing. I don't know about any of you who have ever stolen anything in your life. Stealing usually doesn't include guilt.
No.
It has a certain element of shame available if you get caught. But it truly feels like you are taking something that is yours and the other person has it.
It's a power game. It means to the mind of the person who's engaging in it, it means I can access what I need at any given time because I give myself permission and I do it in spite of whatever anyone else might say. And it gives a feeling of success, almost close to succeeding, you know, earning something, because you feel like you've overcome those who are trying to keep you down.
Well, in effect, you know, it's not only the oppression, but it does seem to play a part in it. It is a feeling of power to somebody who is powerless. I know a man who goes around always asking people to give him money. He says, "Will you lend me $20? He has no intention on paying it back. He feels that culturally, since he came from a race of people who were deprived, that any time he asks anybody for money and they have $20 to spare, he's entitled to that money. It's like the people who get on the phone and sell products on the phone, who call you up, the cold callers. they are being told in their effort to get you to sign up for something, they're being told by their superiors, that person you're calling has your money. It's your money. You have to go get it from that person who you're calling who doesn't want to give you that money. So when those cold callers get on the phone, they are convinced this is mine that you've got. Even though it's in your bank, it's my money. When I steal from you, I am saying, give me that. It's mine. It belongs to me. When you steal records in a record store, CDs, which you don't have to steal, you know, I mean, or even if you do have to, well, you don't have to steal. Whenever you take something that's not yours, it's believed, usually justified.
And, you know, the fact that in a modern society like ours where there's such abundance and where really even the people who are the least affluent have access to all kinds of goodies, stealing seems almost superfluous. Why would it have been selected for and reinforced as an adaptation? But if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense, because throughout evolution, those who were able to grab what they needed whenever it would show up, the moment it would show up, those were the people who would survive in a famine, in a drought, in a concentration camp, in, you know, situations where the rest of them would perish. So stealing is one impulse that many people have difficulties controlling. And already, as Armand is saying, that tells you that here's a person who has been neglected in some form. And it could have been only emotional. It could have been neglected, in a house made of gold.
That's one, stealing, just to imagine it. Now we're going to look at self-mutilation for a moment, because this is a funny thing. People who have an impulse to self-mutilate, you must have met somebody like it or read about it. People would cut themselves with knives or with scissors, or just cut themselves or burn themselves or squeeze their skin between rocks just to feel pain. Where does that come from? Listen to this sentence. Under conditions of scarcity, the optimal fitness maximizing strategy entails a reduction in sensations, insensitivity to costs. I know it's going to be complex, including the risk of bodily harm. I'm going to say it again. Under conditions of scarcity, the optimal fitness maximizing strategy entails a reduction in sensitivity to costs, including the risk of bodily harm. Here's what it's saying. It's saying that if you have a risk, if you are very sensitive to pain, it is very likely that you're going to hurt yourself over and over again, so you become less sensitive to pain. The person who takes a razor blade and cuts themselves purposely gives themselves pain. Does that mean they're getting the endorphins and that they're pain junkies? Well, maybe so. Maybe that's part of it. But the other part of it is they are reducing their sensitivity to pain. One time I was having some kind of surgical procedure and they gave me, I remember, morphine. And I remember this feeling in my mind, which was amazing, how far I could think or how much I thought my brain was expanded. Because all the parts of me that would pay attention to the part of me that was guarding against pain no longer had to pay attention. Little wonder that people are addicted to opiates and things like that, because they take away your fear of pain. So people, yes, who are cutting themselves are reducing their fear of pain because they have a tremendous sensitivity to pain.
Well, and also fear of pain, since pain is usually associated with injury, fear of pain is one of the things that is the most enhanced, let's say, in human beings, meaning that humans will go a long way to avoid pain. Humans will invest a lot of energy in the avoidance of pain. Humans will think a lot of strategies to avoid pain. Now, if you grow up in an environment where you're likely to encounter a lot of pain, there's a tremendous advantage in not feeling pain and being numb so that you don't have to invest all that energy in avoiding it.
Well, you know,
and
I'm not so sure.
And you made the example, Armand, of boxers.
Yeah, I'm not so sure it's not feeling pain. It's having pain become familiar.
Yeah, so that you no longer have to invest all that energy in avoiding it.
Yeah, it's only pain.
But of course, then this goes hand in hand with risk-taking behavior, meaning that if you're not afraid of getting hurt, you may engage in behaviors that other people consider, you know, not desirable because they're riskier.
In fact, people who are self-cutters have a higher rate of accidents. See, because they're not looking.
And so are people who grew up in environments where there's a lot of pain.
Right. So this kind of connection is amazing. Now, we've only got about 6 minutes, Roberta, and I must get to this eating thing.
Yes, that is really...
It is just fascinating. I'll continue with this tomorrow with you, my friends. But let's get on to this thing about eating.
I want to say that they did a study for 6 months with 36 healthy young males. These are guys that started out healthy on all levels. They were not obese. They were not sick in any way. But they submitted voluntarily to a study whereby they took a diet that was nutritionally balanced and complete, but calorically, I think it's deficient, meaning that they... lost weight. They lost 25% of their weight by the time the study was through. But the interesting thing was that during the 6 months, these people that were all considered healthy to begin with all became compulsive about something. Some of them became suicidal. Some of them became self-mutilators. Some of them became thieves. All of them, all across
anger,
the board,
violence,
100%. Yes, violence.
Like crazy.
Yes, one of them said that he was sitting at restaurants and he was looking at people across the table from him, thinking that he was going to throw his food at them because they were irritating him. These are people that started out normal. Now, let's look now at obese people. Obese people who engage in dieting, repeated dieting, where they restrict their food intake or they fast and they're told that this is medically sound. Oh, my God. These are people that may start out with a problem that is relatively small and easy to solve and end up with a problem that's huge because they activate a mechanism which is then once activated is there for the duration whereby their bodies believe that there is famine to be feared and therefore that person is going to be engaging in binge eating forever because that mechanism has been activated.
So if you starve...
Did I say that in a way that made sense? That was clear?
I think so. If you starve...
We all have that mechanism. That's what I was trying to say. It's not just some people. We all have it.
If you starve, and if you starve a person, and if they get a sense that they're being starved without them consciously being sensed, the internal organism goes off, and it goes off, and the compensation takes place, impulse. We're starving. Let's do something. You get angry. You steal. You could do any number of things. Get violent. Go to drug abuse. So it is dangerous. Now, on the other side of this, anorexia is fascinating. Fascinating, fascinating. It's all about impulse control. We think of fat people as being people who don't have impulse control, right? You're overweight. You don't have impulse control, right? That's what we think of. But do you think of anorexics? People who are skinny as a rail, do you think of them having an impulse control? Or bulimics, you think of them as having impulse control? Well, certainly they do. These are more starving than the overweight people.
Well, it all turns out to be associated with serotonin levels, which are involved in impulse control and lack thereof. When a person starves themselves, in their nervous system is activated this dynamic whereby the next time they allow themselves to eat a crumb of something, they no longer have the capacity to stop because now their body says, uh-oh, I better eat as much as I can, as quickly as I can. And this is actually something you see in wolves, in wild animals, that when they get a hold of something, they wolf it down. Yes, because they don't know when they're going to find something else to eat again. The same thing happens to human beings.
What's that? Get to anorexia. We have 30 seconds.
Well, that's what I'm saying, that anorexics have the same dynamic because they deprive themselves of food. When they let themselves eat again, it goes immediately to binge eating. It doesn't go to normalcy. It goes to binge because now the impulsivity has to set in order to save the person's life. It's like the brain of the person says, uh-oh, I better eat as much as I can because I don't know, tomorrow I may not get anything.
So then why are they working so hard at controlling the intake? Because they sense they're out of control?
Well, it's
why does the anorexic? It's very complex.
It's more complex than that, but usually it starts out because a person has an emotional imbalance that leads to some dysfunction in serotonin and dopamine and endorphins.
So
they learn that this behavior around food allows them to have some control over their way they feel. And so they starve themselves because it feels good. But then what they don't know is that what comes next is an impulse activation that they're no longer able to stop.
We have to stop. We have to stop because our impulse would be to continue with you for the entire day. We have to get going. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM. We've been talking to you, Roberta Maria Atti, and I have been talking to you about impulsivity, and there's just so much more to it. I think I'll be bringing you more of it tomorrow.
My website, it's creativehealthsolutions.org with an S at the end.
Yes, and thepositivemind.com. You know, you got to remember with Creative Health Solutions, it's an org at the end.
Right.
As in organ, as in organic.
Right.
CreativeHealthSolution.organic.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Organized.
Organized. ThePositiveMind.com. Hey, listen, I'll be back with you tomorrow, my friends, at 1 p.m. So much more to bring to you about this. Thank you.